Hello, this is the Abstract Podcast, the podcast that takes the new scientific literature of veterinary pathology to you. No fluff, no stress, just an easy way to catch up with what is new while you drive, exercise, or have breakfast.
We search PubMed every week and select the studies relevant to veterinary pathology that were added this week. You then decide if you prefer to go and read the whole manuscript later. I am Sarah.
And I am Alex. We are AI-generated hosts, but the science discussed is grounded in PubMed. So this is the week from June 7th, 2026 to June 13th, 2026. All right, let's start with the specialty pathology journals. First up is a paper on something we see all the time but maybe don't scrutinize enough, the nipple. This is from Casali and colleagues at the Universidade Federal de Minas Gerais in Brazil, published in the Journal of Comparative Pathology. It's a retrospective study looking at lesions in 173 canine mammary papillae. They wanted to characterize what kinds of lesions, mammary, cutaneous, or developmental, affect this often overlooked structure.
Well, the sample size of 173 papillae is quite robust for a descriptive pathology study. It is retrospective, of course, so they're at the mercy of the quality of the original submissions and records. The study simply categorized the lesions found.
And the findings are pretty compelling. Of the papillae with lesions, nearly three-quarters were mammary in origin, and most were neoplastic. This really drives home the point that when we get a mastectomy sample, we can't just ignore the papilla. It can harbor significant pathology, mostly malignant, that is critical for a complete diagnosis.
The conclusion is sound that routine histopathological assessment is essential. It's not groundbreaking methodology, but it is a useful, large-scale confirmation of a clinical suspicion. It simply highlights a gap in routine examination.
Staying in the Journal of Comparative Pathology, we're moving from dogs to an endangered species. This is from Quandl and colleagues at Ludwig Maximilians University in Munich, Germany. It's a retrospective study reviewing morbidity and mortality in 64 captive Przewalski's horses from necropsy reports spanning nearly 50 years from 1973 to 2021.
64 horses is a decent number for an exotic species, but a 48-year time frame, that's a massive variable, Alex. Diagnostic capabilities, husbandry practices, even diet formulations would have changed dramatically. That introduces a significant potential for bias when pooling the data.
I hear you on that, but for a species that was extinct in the wild, this kind of long-term data is gold. They found infectious disease was the most common cause of death, followed by trauma. And the GI tract was the most frequently affected organ system. It gives zoos and conservation programs actual data to work with, focusing on things like peripartum hygiene to reduce neonatal infections, or managing social dynamics to reduce trauma.
True. The descriptive data is valuable for management. Just be cautious drawing firm statistical conclusions from such a chronologically diverse data set. It's a useful overview, not a definitive epidemiological study.
Now let's jump over to the Journal of Veterinary Emergency and Critical Care for a very practical, hands-on study. This is led by Gillette from the University of Calgary in Canada. It's a crossover randomized study comparing POCUS-guided versus landmark-guided thoracostomy tube placement in canine cadavers performed by 30 veterinary students. The goal was to see which teaching method was more effective for this critical skill.
Ah, an educational study. A crossover design with 30 students is a solid approach. It means each student acted as their own control, which is good. Obviously, a cadaver model can't replicate the dynamics of a live, breathing patient. But for teaching initial placement, it's ethically sound.
Right. And the results were interesting. The landmark-guided technique was actually faster. But, and this is the key part for teaching, the students felt significantly more confident that the tube was correctly placed when they used ultrasound. Complication rates were similar between groups, though there were still quite a few extra pleural placements overall.
So faster but less certain versus slower but more confident.
Exactly. For a novice learner performing a high-stakes procedure, that boost in confidence from seeing the placement on ultrasound could be critical for reducing stress and ensuring they perform the procedure correctly under pressure. It suggests POCUS is an invaluable teaching tool, even if it adds a few minutes to the clock initially. Okay, let's move into the general veterinary journals. We have a big feline internal medicine paper from JAVMA. This is from Severac and colleagues, a multi-center study looking at feline chylothorax. It's a retrospective case series of 35 cats, aiming to identify the most common underlying causes and any factors that could predict etiology or outcome.
35 cats is a reasonable number for chylothorax. It being a retrospective study from two centers means we have to consider the usual limitations, potential for missing data, and selection bias for referral cases. No controls were used. It's descriptive.
And the big takeaway is that cardiac disease was the number one cause, found in 57% of cases. That's a huge clinical pointer. In fact, they found that all cats with a left atrial to aortic ratio greater than 1.4 had a cardiac cause. That's a powerful diagnostic clue right there.
That is a strong association. They also noted that cats with neoplastic chylothorax were significantly older, and that low rectal temperature on arrival was a negative prognostic indicator regardless of the cause.
So for clinicians, the message is clear. A cat presents with chylothorax, you need to perform an echocardiogram. It's the most likely underlying cause, and the prognosis for cardiac cases was significantly worse than for idiopathic ones. A very practical paper. We're now into the broader journals. First, a paper on a major issue in cattle production, calf pneumonia. Akaitz and colleagues from Selçuk University in Turkey published this in Tropical Animal Health and Production. They took lung tissue from 100 necropsied calves with pneumonia and used IHC to detect Pasteurella multocida, then ran PCR on the positive cases to look for macrolide resistance genes.
This is a solid molecular pathology study. A sample size of 100 is good. Using IHC to localize the agent within the lesions and then PCR on those same fixed tissues to check for resistance genes is a methodologically sound approach. It directly links the pathogen in the tissue to its resistance profile.
And they found P. multocida in over half the cases, predominantly in lungs with fibrinous bronchopneumonia. But here's the kicker. Of those positive cases, 71% had at least one macrolide resistance gene. That's a very high number.
Indeed. The most common profiles were combinations of two or even three resistance genes. It paints a rather grim picture of antimicrobial resistance in this population.
Absolutely. It highlights that treatment failures aren't just a possibility. They're likely, given the genetic landscape. This strongly supports the need for routine molecular resistance screening to guide antibiotic selection in outbreaks of bovine respiratory disease. Staying with cattle, let's talk about bovine tuberculosis. This study comes from Albertian colleagues at the Universidade Federal de Pelotas in Brazil, published in Veterinary Research Communications. They examined 36 tissue samples from a slaughterhouse that had lesions suggestive of BTB, correlating the histopathology with PCR detection.
A sample size of 36 is on the smaller side. A key point here is that their PCR targeted the 16 srRNA gene, which detects mycobacterium species but isn't specific for M. bovis. So they found mycobacterial DNA, not necessarily the causative agent of bovine T-B. That's an important distinction.
A very good point. Still, their comparison is useful. PCR detected mycobacterial DNA in almost all samples, while the traditional Ziehl-Neelsen stain was only positive in about 60%. It shows the superior sensitivity of molecular testing, especially in low bacilli lesions.
They also described two main histological patterns, classical, well-encapsulated granulomas, and more disorganized ones. The disorganized lesions had more neutrophils, suggesting a more active, poorly contained infection.
Right, and that's important for meat inspectors and pathologists. Recognizing these more atypical, disorganized patterns is crucial for effective surveillance in slaughterhouses. It's a good reminder that TB doesn't always read the textbook. Let's move to a primate pathology report, also in Veterinary Research Communications. Silva and colleagues in Brazil present a case of high parasitism in a common marmoset, Calithrix jacus. This was a single, debilitated female rescued from a peri-urban area.
It's a case report, Alex. N of one. We can't draw any conclusions about prevalence or risk factors. It is purely an observation.
Of course. But it's an important observation. They found a heavy burden of the nematode Primosubulura jacki, and, for the first time in this primate species, an infestation with the tick Rhipicephalus sanguineus, sensu lato. The common brown dog tick.
Ah, right. The first report of a vector is significant.
Exactly. It highlights the issue of spillover. As these primates adapt to urban environments, they encounter parasites from domestic animals. This has implications not just for the health of the marmosets, but also for disease transmission cycles involving pets and potentially people. It's a classic One Health snapshot. Next up is a systematic review on a hot topic in canine oncology, published in the journal Vaccine. This is from Lei Tao and colleagues at the University of Sao Paulo. They systematically reviewed 24 studies on the use of autologous tumor-based vaccines in dogs to evaluate their safety, immunogenicity, and therapeutic effect.
A systematic review is excellent. It provides a high-level overview of the existing evidence. However, the abstract makes it quite clear that the quality of that evidence is variable. The review found substantial heterogeneity across study designs, particularly for solid tumors, with very few randomized controlled trials.
True. The evidence for efficacy is still shaky. The authors themselves are cautious, but one consistent finding was safety. The vaccines were generally very well tolerated, with only mild, transient side effects. That's a huge plus when you're talking about cancer therapy.
That is an important finding. Safety first.
And they did see some promising signals, particularly in lymphoma, where some studies showed longer time to progression. The review's conclusion is really a call to action. We need more standardized, prospective studies to figure out where these vaccines fit. But for now, they seem to be a safe option to consider. Now for a paper on goats. From Case Reports in Veterinary Medicine, Yadav and colleagues in Oman and Nepal described 5 cases of giant subcutaneous fibrosarcoma on the ears of goats.
5 cases. It's a small case series. The value is purely descriptive, to document a clinical presentation. Methodology is limited to just describing what they saw.
Right, but for a practitioner in a field with limited diagnostic facilities, which the authors mention, this is useful. They describe these as huge, rapidly growing, firm masses on the ear. Histology confirmed densely packed spindle cells consistent with fibrosarcoma.
So the take-home is that if a goat presents with a massive ear lump, fibrosarcoma should be high on the differential list.
Precisely. It's a simple paper, but it provides a valuable diagnostic anchor for large animal vets who might not see these tumors often. It emphasizes the need for histopathology to confirm the diagnosis and guide prognosis, as they were highly infiltrative. Let's turn to some reproductive science now, from the journal Cryobiology. This work is from Dias de Luz and colleagues at the Federal University of Pelotas in Brazil. They compared 2 methods, slow freezing versus solid surface vitrification, for cryopreserving testicular tissue from 15 pubertal dogs.
An experimental study with an N of 15 is decent for this kind of tissue-level work. They used good objective markers for cellular health, mitochondrial potential, reactive oxygen species, and lipid peroxidation, in addition to histology.
They found that vitrification, or SSV, was superior. It preserved mitochondrial function better and resulted in less oxidative stress compared to slow freezing. However, interestingly, the histology scores for things like cellular distinction were actually better with the slow freezing method.
So a trade-off. Better cell function with one method, but better looking structure with another. That's a bit of a conundrum. The vitrified tissue also had less structural damage, like basal membrane retraction.
The authors concluded that vitrification was the superior method overall, weighing the functional markers more heavily. This has real implications for setting up germplasm banks for canine breeding programs, or for preserving the fertility of dogs undergoing gonadotoxic treatments. It's a step towards optimizing those protocols. Next, a parasitology paper from Scientific Reports, looking at a new way to tackle a very old problem. Abdel Ghani and colleagues in Egypt developed and tested different ivermectin nanoformulations for topical activity against the Rhipicephalus sanguineus tick.
This is interesting, but the abstract is frustratingly vague on a key methodological point, the in vivo trial. It mentions one was performed, but gives no details on the number of animals, the model used, or the outcomes. Not reported. That makes it impossible to critically evaluate that part of the study.
That's a fair criticism. But the in vitro work is well described. They created several nanoformulations, and found one based on spanelastics had the best physical properties, small particle size, and high encapsulation efficiency. In the lab, this formulation was highly effective, with a very low LC50 against adult ticks.
So it works in a petri dish. That's a start.
It is. The goal here is to create safer, more effective alternatives to conventional acaricides, especially with resistance on the rise. A topical nanoformulation could offer sustained release, reducing the frequency of application and improving efficacy. It's an intriguing proof of concept, even if the in vivo details are sparse. And for our last paper, we're heading into the world of exotic animal anatomy, also from Scientific Reports. This study is by Klikowska Narot and colleagues in Poland. It provides the first detailed morphological and histochemical characterization of the eyelids and orbital glands of the crocodile monitor.
The first, perhaps, but it's based on two individuals. Two. The authors themselves state the findings should be interpreted as descriptive baseline observations. I'd go further and call it a pilot report. You can't characterize a species based on an N of two.
I understand the skepticism, Sarah, but for some of these rare, non-model species, getting samples is incredibly difficult. You have to start somewhere. They did a very thorough analysis with multiple stains on the tissue they had.
And what did they find in these two monitors?
They described osteoderms in the eyelids, which is cool, and characterized the mucin production of the Hardarian and lacrimal glands. The Hardarian gland produced a mix of acidic and neutral mucins, while the lacrimal gland produced only acidic ones. It's foundational anatomical work that's essential for veterinary ophthalmologists and pathologists working with these species. It might be a small N, but it's a start.
That wraps up this week's literature. Please remember that an abstract-only appraisal cannot evaluate full methodology. The scope of this podcast is to provide a taster to stimulate your appetite to read the actual manuscripts of those papers that capture your interest.
Also, please note that we are AI-generated hosts and may occasionally get details wrong. It is ultimately your responsibility to double-check the veracity of the information, particularly if this is going to affect your clinical practice. Thanks for listening.